You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we don't believe in conspiracy theories, but if we did, they'd involve a pedophile billionaire, suicide watch, suicide, and cameras malfunctioning. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you feel a little insane right now because you agree with Twitter, maybe, then you found yourself in the right place. Why don't you tell a friend about us as well? Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I think Midsider Elliott said it best, actually, on Facebook when he said, no matter your political, philosophical differences this week, we can come together as Americans knowing that Richard Epstein was totes killed, or whatever his name was.
Okay, I'm glad that you're on the same
Jeffrey.
Page here. Because,
sorry, Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, I was
Richard
like,
Epstein is a professor of
fine.
Law.
Fine. But he's a fine, upstanding man, Richard Epstein. Let's not confuse those two. When you said that, I was like, I'm going to let that one go. But yes, please do not besmirch Richard Epstein's name. But I'm glad you are on the same page here, because part of me wondered if you were going to come in here and like say the rational point of view, and maybe I've just been on Twitter too much.
Look, the rational point of view is we actually don't know what happened, right? So
right.
The Atlantic is already writing this article about how conspiracy theorists can't accept the official story for whatever it is. It's like, well, there is no official story yet. We were told he was killed, but there hasn't been that he killed himself, but there hasn't been an investigation yet. Let's wait for that to bear out. But the circumstances are highly suspicious, and so it's fine to, I think, be questioning the suicide story at this point.
Yeah, and there are multiple conspiracies as to what happened. Some people are saying he was killed. Other people are saying that he was switched out in a van and he's actually in witness protection somewhere.
Yeah, I'm not going to go that route. I think he is dead, as the quote-unquote official story would say. But the suicide thing
but
is a little strange.
Have you seen the pictures, Daniel, of the comparison of the bridge of his nose to the bridge of the corpse's nose? I'm not saying I agree with that. It's just how far down the rabbit hole people are going.
Are the pictures in front of barrels of jet fuel? Or I don't.
They are on the moon.
They're on the moon. I see. No, I don't go down that far in the conspiracy theory of rabbit hole. I will simply go as far as to say that there are two things that are highly believable here to me. One is that he was killed by someone. That's highly believable to me. And the second thing that's highly believable to me is this was simply a massive government screw-up, that they are just incompetent to the core, that government can do nothing right, even one of its core functions, i.e. the criminal justice system, and he killed himself even though he was under surveillance and suicide watch and had guards and everything else, because government can do nothing right.
Wait, hold on a second. The cat's trying to kill herself. Hold on.
The cat is trying to kill herself, or Hillary Clinton is trying to kill your cat? What does your cat know about the Clintons, Justin?
But she's tangled up in the cords for my computer and everything's gonna fall down. Hold on.
Your cat is trying to hang herself during our discussion of Jeffrey Epstein hanging himself. I feel like your cat might have been some places and seen some things. Is there a pet carry-on for the Lolita Express? This is the part of the show where I filibuster while Justin saves the life of his cat and I mercilessly mock him. But nonetheless, Justin, your podcasts are getting in the way of our show, and I'm sure the audience doesn't appreciate it. Or maybe they do. Maybe they love cats. Maybe they love awkward talking while Justin goes away. Justin has now texted me to say, quote, hold on, end quote. That's an ambiguous phrase. Hold on to what? I don't know. My horses? Stop recording? He didn't say that. He just said, hold on. And I can't let there be silence. Because that's bad pod. And we don't give bad pod here on the Midside. So one thing I'll say while Justin is saving his cat's life is I did an interview recently with Unsafe Spaces with Carter and Carrie, although this was just with Carter, on the topic of
testing,
fracking.
Testing. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're back now.
Yeah, and I'm recording. So what happened is, and I'm interested to hear about the fracking thing in 2 seconds, but what happened is my cat got tangled up in the cord for the mic and unplugged the mic. So that's why I disappeared.
Well, I kept talking during the entire time. So you actually don't have to cut any of this out. I mean, it's horrible podcasting, but it's at least it's at least words. It's not a bunch of silence.
So tell us about this fracking thing.
Okay, so yeah, to recap, I was invited to be on Unsafe Spaces with Carter and Carrie, being interviewed by Carter, and he wanted to talk about fracking, specifically my role in Frack Nation and the fracking myths that still pertain to this day. And we talked a little bit about energy philosophy, and we talked about environmentalism and the hatred of mankind and all the fun topics that we get into here on the Midside, and had a good conversation with him. So that interview will drop soon. So why don't you check it out on Unsafe Spaces? Gina Gorland was recently on there, another objectivist. She's a psychologist. So having some interesting interviews on that show. And I thought the conversation went really well. Plugged the Midside. Told everyone to come here, subscribe to us. So if there's people out there who came here from Unsafe Spaces, assuming these things cross wires at some point, then welcome to the Midside.
They came for a cat suicide.
That's right. You go from in-depth energy philosophy discussion to a cat killing itself over its sadness of Jeffrey Epstein's passing.
Is this podcast or whatever it is? Are they using your philosophy of not first, just right? I mean, how many years ago was Frack Nation?
I know, but look, here's the thing about it. Frack Nation, long time ago. Fracking issue, still on the table. And I think looking at it now as a retrospective from 2013, 2014, it's interesting to see how much we won this issue. Which is fascinating. That's not to say that the energy philosophy discussion overall has been won, but specifically on fracking, it was a fun retrospective to look back at all the arguments about environmental disaster, and in a few years, these places will be unlivable, etc., when in fact they are booming. So that was a fun look down memory lane, and at the sort of general environmentalist movement at large, so.
Yeah, and that's a huge win. It's hugely important. And I have to ask you about something else and ask if it's the next win or if it's already a loss. Did you guys discuss paper straws?
We didn't get into that topic, but it is a good topic. And I think at the moment it's a loss, but it is a battlefield where I think we have the heavy artillery on our side because goddamn are those paper straws terrible.
They're terrible. It's such a micro thing, right? Like, that's going to save the oceans. That's going to save the environment. And here's another thing. Here's what I think is going to be the nail in the coffin for this issue. It might be the nail in the coffin for environmentalists. When I was in Orlando, there was a restaurant we went to where they had a plastic straw made out of plant.
Yes.
So the idea that they've convinced us we need paper straws when there's an alternative to plastic straws that work just as well and are also good for the environment just shows what the true agenda is, doesn't it? Doesn't it show that they're just trying to make us suffer?
Well, it's certainly yes, and it is certainly a governmental type fix, right? Which is we won't look into innovation. We won't look into something new and interesting and better. What we'll do is make you go back to an era when something was terrible. And we'll mandate it universally. So in DC, for instance, there's you are not allowed to have plastic straws. The end. And that's it. And the government has spoken. And that's it until there's some sort of mini riot on City Hall. But yeah, the plant-based plastic things work 90% as well. I would say they're sufficient. Whereas the paper straws don't work at all.
Right. That's what I was going to say. The paper straws work so terribly that
they just don't
I'm
work.
Able to deal with the the plant-based plastic.
That's right.
Dude, I tried to have a milkshake. I tried to have a milkshake in Universal, and I just honestly, I had to throw the straw out and drink it out of the cup straight. It didn't work at all. I literally could not get any suction.
Yes. Which defeats the purpose of a straw.
Yeah. It's not a straw.
You essentially
at that point.
Put a paper stirrer, a terrible paper stirrer, into my milkshake.
Yeah. It's just,
disgusted. He's just disgusted, ladies and gentlemen.
I am. This is something I'm working on. Not fixing it, but I'm actually working on a stand-up bit about this. And I may try stand-up because of the plastic straw issue. So maybe there is some good to come out of this.
It's a good opening line. I'm only here tonight, folks, because of paper straws. I was a quiet, unassuming suburbanite until they forced the paper straw down my throat.
Okay, that's a good way for you to start. I was thinking of starting about how... I look younger than I am, but I act older than I am. And going for not saying that, but going with that gimmick.
I see. The pedophile gimmick. Got it.
Yes. No. Okay. Nothing to do with that. Okay. Now that we've talked way too much about pedophiles, there was a lot of other crazy shit that happened, I think. I feel like we had an extremely farcical week this week, so much so that I had to cut stuff out. So why don't we head into it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
It really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Before we get to the news, reminder that we have a Patreon channel. That's patreon.com/themidside, where you, our wonderful, loyal, fantastic listeners, can go and give us a couple bucks every time we produce this show, and it helps us do things like keep the lights on. patreon.com/themidside. Walmart in the news this week for a shooting incident, of course, where 22 people were killed in El Paso. But for another reason, which is that Walmart has decided, at least temporarily, to remove violent and aggressive video game displays from its stores. Its stores that will also keep selling guns. So, Walmart has removed these displays, at least temporarily. They sent a memo to store employees basically telling them to take down advertisements for first-person shooter games or hunting games, combat style, or any third-person aggressive, behavioral, violent-themed games, specifically for PlayStation and Xbox. Walmart said that this is a temporary thing and does not necessarily necessitate a change in their policy of what video games they'll be selling going forward. They also said they will continue to sell guns, and there has been no change in policy, according to them. Walmart employees, though, are planning a mass, quote, sick out strike in the hopes of persuading the company to stop selling guns and ammunition altogether. According to CNN, three coworkers emailed more than 20,000 employees within the company on an internal messaging system calling for a sick out, i.e. calling in sick, and saying that those who are unable to call in sick for financial reasons or otherwise should at least wear black on that day to protest. Justin, problem solved, right? No more violent video game displays, no more violence.
Oh, that's the direction we're going with this? Okay.
Whatever direction you want to go with it, but that's my question to you.
Yeah, that's clearly going to stop everything. If we just get rid of the violent video games and the violent movies, it's going to stop, you know, all of the fucked up psychology and the fucked up philosophy we have in this culture.
Because everyone knows that before there were video games, there was total world peace and harmony.
Yeah. There were no young men going out and killing people in the pre-technology era.
Never.
Never.
Not once. It Pong comes along and the whole thing just collapses. Like,
yeah, I saw that
in the cupboard.
Meme. But I think that meme is actually a bit misfired. They should put in whatever the first violent video game is.
I don't know. Pong, you're shooting this little missile back and forth at each other. It's pretty, and when you lose, it goes womp womp.
That's a microaggression. That's a macroaggression. When you lose,
it's pretty
video
violent
games.
To me. And then don't even get me started on Donkey Kong. My God,
dude, the ape is throwing barrels at you. That's racist. It's you have to save the princess. It's the patriarchy. There's just so much wrong with Donkey Kong.
Ruined our society. But then Donkey Kong Country fixed it temporarily, and then it got ruined again. But go on. Sorry, I digress.
This is just PR. Walmart had to do something, didn't they? They had to do something to address the fact that this happened in their stores. I'm not saying it's their fault that things happened in their stores, but they had to do something or they were going to be destroyed by the media machine.
Yeah.
I mean, even the way this article is written, Daniel, I mean, the idea that the headline is they're not going to advertise violent video games anymore, but they'll still sell guns. This is written from the perspective of you need to ban guns, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. Because again, to continue a theme here, we all know the world was perfectly peaceful with no murder whatsoever before guns were introduced to culture. And then look out, man.
I'd just like to point out, I don't know if you saw this story, Daniel, but this past week there were multiple stabbings near me. And I mean literally right down the street. Like this guy was like running around stabbing people. Apparently he stopped at a gas station to pump gas and there was a guy next to him and he just took out machetes and killed the guy.
Jeez Christ. My God. Yeah, I was waiting for you to go on Facebook and mark yourself as safe, but I didn't see it, so I assumed you had been macheted to death.
Or that I don't use Facebook anymore to the point that I missed your wife's birthday party.
That's right. So here's the thing about this. Walmart did have to do something. You're right about that. Any number of things they could have done, including hiring an armed security guard, for instance, at every store across the country. That would help, at least to some degree. Or, you know, having some sort of alert system or having emergency routes or whatever it is. But stopping advertising violent video games is not going to work. And certainly if they stop selling guns, that would also not work. In places that have no guns or fewer guns or guns are illegal, people still die. Turns out people are still murdered. I mean, not just die of old age. They are still murdered. London, where guns are totally banned, is one of the least safe cities, major cities in the world. So it's about the mentality. It's about what would cause someone to want to murder someone in the first place, or many people. It doesn't matter what the means of it is. Yes, a gun can help it be sort of more efficient, but if someone is crazy or if someone is manic or if someone is violent and they just want to hurt someone, they will find a way to do it. We were very efficient at killing people in the world well before guns got here.
Yeah, ask the Japanese about that. That was very efficient.
The Huns? Genghis Khan?
No, I was referring to the fact
Persian
that,
Empire?
You know, we invented a bomb that killed, like, a lot of people in one time. That's what I was referring to.
Yes, that too.
Yeah. No, let me ask you, though. So let's pivot a little bit, and this may be well-tread territory on the mid-side here, but I think what you were saying leads into it, because everything you said is very well taken. But isn't there an issue now that this is happening so frequently? Or alternately, is it not happening as frequently? And that's just the media stirring shit up.
But that's the ultimate question. And it goes down to a lot of it into definitions of what you mean by mass shooting or gun violence or whatever. The FBI statistics that count mass shootings as 4 or more deaths, not including the shooter, say that this is not really happening any more frequently than it was. So, you know, you can define it lower as 3 or more or 2 or more, not including the shooter, and then you get a spike depending on the stats you're looking at. And then a lot of gun violence that we don't talk about, well, some people do talk about it in the context of gun control, but most gun violence in America is one-on-one gun violence. And in fact, deaths by guns, the vast majority of death by guns is suicide. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that there is a sort of cultural psychology that's increasing that would make people more violent in an era when overall things are getting safer, and we should look at that and we should figure out what that is.
I'm glad you went in this direction, because the question I want to ask you is, is the difference now that the people who are doing this, rather than before, are more performative now? And what I mean by this is the trend I'm seeing seems to all be mimicking the trappings of the Columbine killing, where they dress up a certain way, they get similar kind of weapons, and they act in a certain way. So it seems to be they're more worried about the performative aspect of it. Whereas before, people would just, it seemed, get upset and go kill a few people. Now it seems they want to be known and they want to be seen, and they're doing a performance.
Yeah, I think experts now agree that there is a copycatness to this, or a contagiousness almost to this, where you see one and then people want that same kind of notoriety for some horrifying reason that we don't 100% understand. So yes, I think there is that. I think social media certainly makes people more aware of it, and the more people who are aware of it, the more people who are likely to do it to get the notoriety themselves. So it's a sort of vicious cycle in that regard. There have been a lot of proposed reasons for this, some of which have scientific validity, some of which don't, like all these people are on psychotropic drugs. Does that have something to do with it? One of the more interesting ones, I think, because it's one that won't get talked about at all, is that every single one of these shooters and all the major shooters that we know about in the past decade or, oh God, going on 20 years now with Columbine, no father in the home, or father was abusive, or father traumatized them when they were young, or whatever, but basically no relationship with the father or horrific relationship with the father.
Yeah, and I'd love
that
to see...
That says something?
Yeah, yeah, and I'd love to see a Mindhunter-style series where Mindhunter seems to be very critical of the mother's relationship with these serial killers. I'd love to see a same style, or maybe a spin-off of Mindhunter about the opposite, the lack of father in the home leading to these sort of people. I think that would be a fascinating show as well.
Yeah, I just think it's sort of an Adam Carolla-ism here, and we'll get back to him in the last story. So
yes,
hold on to that.
Huh.
But it's the idea of, like, there is never going to be enough police, military, whatever, to stop bad things from happening. The first line of defense has to be the family. Families have to be involved in the raising of their kids and understand what's going on in their kids' lives and be able to be the first responders to something bad that's going to happen. And when you have fathers who are abandoning homes, or fathers who are have themselves been traumatized, or having children who are traumatizing those children, you're going to lose that front line of defense, and then the government is necessarily going to be reactionary instead of being able to do anything about these things when they're alerted about them.
Right, exactly. And let's take a perfect example. The story of the guy who strapped himself up and went into Walmart, supposedly in a performative way, that he was never intending to do anything. He just wanted to see how people would react. You saw this story, Daniel?
Yes, I did.
Well, did you see who objected to him? His girlfriend or wife, or I don't remember what relationship they have, what level of their relationship is, and his mother told him it was a bad idea. Where was the father kicking the shit out of him? Being like, you fucking idiot, and stopping him physically, or calling the police. Why did no one call the police? Are you kidding me? I don't care who you are. If you do that, I'm calling the police on you only after I get in your face and try to stop you, and you pull a gun on me and make me let you leave. That's when I call the police. The first thing I do is I try and stop you if I know you and you're going to do that, and you're being that much of an idiot. So
yeah, it really does.
The lack of the male response, and it's something that's been broken out of society now. They're telling us you can't respond in a masculine way.
Right. I was going to say, to take it one more level of abstraction, it's, oddly, I think, because we think of these folks as sort of hyper-masculine or hyper-aggressive or whatever, it's the aggressiveness that's missing from their lives. It's the telling them, no, absolutely not, you are not allowed to do this, or not hitting them, obviously, but I'm being physical, I mean, you know, stopping them, physically stopping them from doing something. It's aggression that's missing from them to some degree. So it's a complex web we have woven in our weird culture, and some of that complexity has to do with our virtue signaling in any given area of life. So speaking of, people are threatening to quit Equinox and SoulCycle, which are gyms, I think. Justin, you can explain that a little bit.
So Equinox is a fancy gym. It was founded in New York City. It's big out here in L.A. It's where really rich, snooty people go. or people in LA who want to prove things. My girlfriend does not go there anymore, but when she was living at home when we first started dating, she told me she goes to Equinox. I was like, okay, and I had no idea what it was at the time. And then, you know, I follow many Patriots and former Patriots on Instagram and social media. Willie McGinnis, three-time Super Bowl champion linebacker, I'm looking at his Instagram story, and he's at Equinox. And I'm like, wait a second. So that tells you the kind of people who go to Equinox. Three-time Super Bowl champion Willie McGinnis is a member at Equinox.
And SoulCycle is that,
an offshoot
but for cycling.
Right, exactly. It's an offshoot. It's owned by Equinox, but it's for cardio. It's something called It's not cycling. What's it called? I can't forget. I spin. It's called spin. And you go there for 45 minutes, and they play really loud music and make you do choreography, and they yell affirmations at you.
Sounds like the worst Broadway show ever. So, speaking
worse
of spin, the movie, certainly. Speaking of spin, the people are now threatening to quit Equinox and SoulCycle because it turns out that the chairman of the brands is hosting a fundraiser for, you guessed it, Donald Trump. So, Stephen Ross, who is a real estate developer and investor, is planning to host a fundraiser for Trump's reelection at his New York home in the Hamptons with tickets starting at $100,000. Ross is the founder and chairman of the real estate company Related Co's and the owner of the Miami Dolphins, so he must be evil. Ross's fundraiser sparked boycott threats from Equinox and SoulCycle fans. The Related companies acquired Equinox in 2005, and Ross sits on the board of directors. SoulCycle is owned by Equinox. So people started tweeting out this information about his fundraiser, and then, of course, there was social media outrage. But this might actually be outrage in the sense that they've actually started to lose customers to the point where SoulCycle and Equinox had to release statements saying that Ross is a, quote, passive investor, and, quote, we want to let you know that Equinox and SoulCycle have nothing to do with the event and do not support it. As is consistent with our policies, no company profits are used to fund politicians. In addition to Equinox and SoulCycle, Related companies have made major investments in the dessert chain Milk Bar. The celebrity chef David Chang's Momofuku restaurant and the fast casual pizza chain And Pizza. So watch out, folks. They're coming for your pizza and Milk Bar next. Justin, what will you be boycotting because of an investor's political views?
Momofuku, because I also don't know what it is.
It's a trendy noodle restaurant.
No, I mean, dude, if I was going to be protesting this, like, it would have been Ben and Jerry's years ago, right? Like, if I was going to do this based upon this sort of principle, it would be Ben and Jerry's. I mean, they fucking, like, gave a commencement speech at my alma mater, Ithaca College, and it was, like, they used it to be anti-war. They didn't even, like, fucking tell people about, like, this is what you do when you graduate. Go live your life and be successful. It was just, like, fuck the war, fuck Bush, fuck W. It's, like, those are the people I would have protested, but, like, here's the thing, right? There's two things about this story to me. The first is, how far do you go with where your money is going? Because, theoretically, all your money is always going back to the government. So, they tax enough that some money you spend somewhere is going back to the government. But, in all seriousness, what I actually mean is, when you're looking at this guy, Stephen Ross, right? He's investing, so he's getting a certain amount of money from this business. But he is a private citizen. And he contracts with the company to say a certain amount of money is going to be used to run this business. And then I, as a private citizen, can do what I want with the money the rest of the time. Now, I share some sympathies here. You know, if he was like, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, right? And it was found out that he was using this money to fund pedophilia. Wouldn't you say, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't give money to this company? But then isn't it the company's responsibility to vet that relationship and end the relationship with the guy? So the point I'm making is, the first point I'm making is, isn't it too far when you're saying, oh, what this guy does with his private money means I can't work with this company that gives me a high value, that I believe is a high value. I can't contract with this company. And then the second thing is, again, the performative nature of this. The idea that, look, dude, this isn't like just, I wonder how much of it is Twitter, but, you know, my girlfriend follows some of these people who work at SoulCycle and stuff on Instagram, and some guy who's gay and works the front desk at SoulCycle, although I repeat myself, people called him, they called SoulCycle and yelled at him and said he was homophobic, hated gays, and was pro-Trump and hung up the phone.
Oy vey. Yeah, it's tough, right? So the Jeffrey Epstein example is a good one because that's a good borderline case, but it's hard because these are, if you go down the list of people who invest in companies, you're going to find someone you disagree with, someone who's done something despicable. Always, because investors, you know, it's not like SoulCycle vets these investors that much, and anyone can buy stock in SoulCycle or Equinox or whatever it is if they're a publicly traded company. So it's hard. And again, I think the key difference here is that Equinox and SoulCycle as a corporation are not donating to Donald Trump or to the Lolita Express Fund or whatever it is. They're companies that are operating, and the people who are investing in them also have interests. In this particular case, Ross is a Republican, and he's a known Republican. He had a fundraiser for Jeb Bush in 2016, who couldn't be further away from Donald Trump. I suspect he's just hosting a fundraiser because he wants a Republican in the White House because he's a Republican. Shock and awe. But we've put Trump on this deranged pedestal of he's the worst thing in the history of Republicanism, which is he's just within the norm of terrible, as we've said many times. There is a range of acceptable and unacceptable, and he fits within that range of terrible that all politicians basically fit into. For me, I would need to know that the company that I'm working with is directly engaging in a disvalue for me in order for me to want to boycott that company. And look, I'm a guy who's an Apple guy, and Al Gore directly sits on the board of Apple. And that, to me, is still sort of fine. Like, Al Gore does a lot of crap. I think he's bad for me. I think he's bad for human beings. But it's not so egregious that I would stop buying Apple products. Now, if Apple said 100% of our profits are going to go fund the Democratic Socialists of America, I would have to stop working with Apple products and switch to godforsaken window products. But that would be a tough decision.
Well, right, and this is why, Daniel, I was distinguishing between the public company and the private citizen. Because to me, that seems to be where the breakdown is here. Because again, I could trace every bit of money I've given to a company to some sort of cause I don't agree with or some sort of idea I don't agree with. I mean, Funko is headquartered in the Northwest, in Washington, just north of Seattle. You think they're supporting what I agree with?
Right. Exactly. I'm sure there are many causes that certainly Funko executives or investors are engaged in that would make us cringe.
What about Funko artists? What about Funko artists? They're getting a paycheck from the company.
Absolutely. And but it's the product, and the company is not sort of directly funding these horrible things, or even if they are, they're not funding them primarily, or it's not their mission. Or I mean, look, I will admit that it is complicated to a certain degree, depending on the extent to which they are engaging in a disvalue for you. But overall, focus on what value they are providing and see if the value outweighs the disvalue. Because if you start on this trend of any disvalue I must disengage myself from in any way, good luck participating in society. Good luck having any friends. Good luck having a job. Good luck being with – because if you are an individualist, you're almost certainly going to find something you find to be a disvalue about everyone you engage with to some degree, depending on how picky you are. So, you know, calm it down, social justice warriors.
Well, and especially when your standard, Daniel, and this is what's well taken about what you're saying, is so abstract and so low level. Your standard is literally just supports Donald Trump. You're not asking why they support right. Donald Trump. It's not, as you said, oh, exactly. He's a Republican, I'm a Republican. It's just, oh, you support Donald Trump, therefore you must be evil and a white supremacist.
Yes. Well, there are other evils in the world, Justin. Apparently one of them is wealth. Vox has an op-ed, something, called Is Wealth Immoral? Written by Adam Roberts, who says, I was born into the 1%. It's time to change the system. Now, there are any number of things about this article that are terrible. We'll get into the ideas that are terrible in this article.
But let's get to the real reason I included this on the show this week.
That it's essentially a Dr. Seuss book for adults.
Oh my God, the death of our culture. I think I've witnessed it in one article.
So we say article, and if you could see our hands, they would be in scare quotes, because this is a series of pictures.
Mine's just giving the middle finger.
With some captions, but also some text written into the pictures, and you sort of have to explore the pictures to figure out what the hell is going on in this quote-unquote
article. It's not a picture book. It's not a graphic novel. It's like not an article. It's like in between everything.
Yeah, it's like a bad infographic molested a Dr. Seuss book and out popped this horrible woke garbage. So here's the gist of it. This guy was born into uber wealth, the 1%. His name is Adam. And he grew up in it, but sort of didn't realize he grew up in it because it was well hidden from him. But then as he got older, he got the talk about the wealth and found out that it was coming from Standard Oil, or large military contractors, or the Pennsylvania banking system. And it was all the things that he hated and grew up to find immoral. Ooh. And so he has this moral conundrum about his wealth, where he doesn't like to spend it, and he thinks it's not fair that people have no money when he has so much money. And he's basically come to resent his wealth. And he's decided that the whole system needs to change, that there essentially should be no billionaires, which is a position also taken by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's former chief of staff. So there are many wrong things with this article, but this is one of the things that bothers me, which is the quote from her policy advisor. Every billionaire is a policy failure. Think about that for a minute. Every billionaire is a policy failure. Justin, could you unpack that for us a little bit and then just go on with how terrible the ideas are in this article?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, and correct me on this, but and someone's going to get mad at me starting with this word rather than building towards it, but I think that quote just reveals a Marxist presupposition. And what I mean by that is, it's the idea that government's role is to redistribute the wealth. It's not to protect the people's rights. It's to redistribute the wealth. So therefore, government is failing if all of the wealth ended up distributed into one person's hands. And this is, I think it's deeply revealing of how much Marxism has crept into our culture in general, whereas we still have this narrative of the haves and the have-nots, and we still have this narrative of the top 1%. And it's not about, oh, how free is everyone? How free is every individual person? We don't talk about that anymore. Our metric of success as a society is no longer how free people are. It's how much the gap is between who has the most and who has the least. Even though the well-tread territory is, there may be people who have the most and people who have the least, but the least off are the most successful, most plentiful least off in the history of the world. But what I'm saying is that shouldn't even be the discussion. The discussion should be, how free is everyone? Is every individual free? But we don't even use that standard anymore, because as this quote is showing, is that Marxism is so just taken for granted as the standard here. And this guy, Daniel, this guy is a perfect example of the leftism in New England. This is a kid that I knew growing up. I'm not saying I knew this specific guy, but I went to a private high school with a lot of doctors and lawyers kids. And you talk about, you know, the leftism on the left coast, right, on the West Coast, where it's all elitism and we know better than you and we're superior, therefore, you know, do what we say. And it's a lot of new wealth out here because, yeah, you know, of the Hollywood industry, the entertainment industry, and everyone moved out here. Well, this is what the old wealth is. And this is guilt about money he didn't earn, money he did not earn, and he feels guilty about it. That's all this simply is. This is all that is, plain and simple. And I've never seen a person who more needs to read the Francisco de Anconia money speech than this guy. He literally gives the lottery example, yes, that Francisco addresses. And he uses, yes, that example. And the reason Francisco uses it, or Rand uses it in Francisco's speech, is because it's a perfect example for unearned wealth.
Yes. And in fact, this guy makes the claim that basically all wealth under capitalism is unearned. So he actually asks the question, is there a moral way to accumulate a fortune under capitalism? And he gives three examples of why it's not. One is, did something cool but didn't distribute the benefits to workers. Number two is, the economy values my skill set way more than other people's, so that's unfair. And the final is, of course, living on land stolen from indigenous peoples with still no monetary reparations from slavery for black people in the U.S. So essentially he's saying that no matter how you make your wealth, you didn't earn that. So like him, like he personally didn't earn it, no one earned their wealth. Therefore, the money doesn't belong to them and should be redistributed to other people. So this of course, has been debunked in a number of ways. Justin mentioned the money speech from Atlas Shrugged, Francisco de Anconia, which is a phenomenal debunking of all of this. I have a sort of nuanced, strange route to take with this, Justin, which is, we're constantly told by the same people, mind you, that money isn't everything. Money can't buy happiness. That love is important. Love trumps hate. Love trumps blah, 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 blah.
But they're obsessed with money.
They're obsessed with money. They're obsessed with cash. Why is it that they cannot look past other... Why can't they look past money to see the value, the other value that is created by these companies, the other value that is created under capitalism? The fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it says her generation has never seen prosperity, that she's tweeting from her iPhone in her heated air-conditioned apartment where she has a 50-inch flat-screen TV and furniture from IKEA and pots and pans and all these things, you know, on the salary of a barista from Starbucks, which is a gig that didn't exist 50 years ago or 500 years ago, and we would have all been toiling day and night just to live. Why is it that cash is the only thing that these people can see?
This is, to go back to something you've said earlier, a failure of family and a failure of culture. Yes. Because of what the family and what the culture is focused on. So the messaging these people are receiving from all sides of their life is that it's the material things that matter and nothing else. They're not being told that other things matter. This kind of kid goes to school in Massachusetts, and what matters? What kind of things is he hearing about? He's not hearing about values. He's not hearing about pursuing your values. He's not hearing about what he should care about. He's caring about get a job. Go to work. Yeah. Get a job. Make money. They're not saying why. They never talk about why. No one ever talks about the purpose of making money. They just say, what are you supposed to do?
The purpose of your life, right? Not just the purpose of making money, the purpose of your life, the reason for you to exist, the thing that motivates you,
right,
your raison d'etre, your internal prime mover, your being, your essence. What is that? And they don't have it.
But when they talk about that and they say your purpose, you need to discover that so you can make money. It's not you make money so you can have your purpose. Everything is backwards in the way. So even when they do talk about that, Daniel, it's, you have to go to work. So find your purpose so you can make your money.
Right.
That's what they talk about. That's how they frame it. And then I'm sure he got that from his family as well. Because what do they care about? They care about it so much that they hid it from him from the time he was a kid.
Right.
They hid it from him. Think about that. Think about that. Think about what that one move says, hiding it from him. Not, we're going to just introduce you to the reality of your life and tell you things are different than other people, but we're going to hide it from you. So what they did was they sheltered him. The only way to hide it from him is shelter him and keep him away from the people who don't have the money.
Yeah. It's so obviously the first emotional reaction I had to this article was fury because it's so horrifying to think that people believe these things. But honestly, and almost as strongly, the second reaction I had to this article was a profound sadness for this guy. That his family so messed up his psychology about value and worth and purpose that he now lives in this life where he has this constant guilt about money and about his family and about capitalism, about all the things that make society great. It must be a horrifying life for him to live, and I'm sorry that he has to live it, that he has his one life and that he's going to spend it feeling this way,
Daniel,
about things that make the world great.
I think a lot of people feel this way, though. I mean, to ground this in something very real that I'm experiencing is, I think that that's the only way California can exist. Because California, you can't really pursue your values because you're spending so much time just trying to survive, because so much of your money goes back to the state, that you can't really pursue your values. That's the number one problem I'm having here. I have to work two jobs just to have the basic material things to survive. And I think people are okay out here because they see it in a material way. Oh, well, the weather is so much better. Oh, well, there's so many more opportunities for entertainment-based things out here.
You can snowboard and surf in the same day.
Right. That's all very material focused. It's all very, and when I say material, ladies and gentlemen, I literally mean material. I mean physical concrete things. That's what they're focused on. Where they're not focused on what gives me the best use of my time so I can pursue my values. So maybe you go somewhere else where the weather's not as great, but you can pursue your values.
Yes. Very good points. Well, speaking of people who stink, or perhaps not, The Guardian out of the UK would like you to meet the people who have stopped washing. Apparently, a growing number of people are eschewing soap and trusting bacteria to do the job instead, and an entire industry has sprung up to accommodate them. David Whitlock has not showered or bathed for 15 years. Yet he does not have any body odor. Quote, it was kind of strange for the first few months, but after I stopped missing it, he says, if I get a specific part of my body dirty, and I'll wash that specific part, but never with soap. Although Whitlock appreciated gaining an extra 15 minutes a day from soap dodging, his primary motivation was to encourage friendly microbes to live on him in a symbiotic harmony. The bacteria get to feast on the ammonia from his sweat, and he gets low-maintenance, balanced skin. So this has become sort of a trend, and Sarah Ballantyne, a medical biophysicist turned author and lifestyle guru, has been an advocate of living in a more, quote, Stone Age way since reaching a very healthy weight after adopting the paleo diet, which folks of the show are probably familiar with. She, too, only uses water to wash, even though she is, quote, at the gym sweating buckets 6 hours a day. She uses coconut oil to shave, and that's it. Over time, quote, my skin has adjusted. I don't smell. Justin, this has been something that one Adam Carolla, our second favorite podcaster, of course, after ourselves, has been saying for a very long time, and he has been known to go months and months without showering or using soap in any way whatsoever. Do you think this is something that's possible for all people, or are there some people who just have a natural body funk that can't be overcome without plenty of Axe body wash?
Are you asking me that question for a specific reason?
No, I'm asking you because it's a podcast and I have to ask you something.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that you're asking me that question because I could not go without showering, especially after going to the gym. I can smell myself while I'm working out. And furthermore, they mentioned something in this article, eczema. Eczema is something I have had since I was a kid. If I do not shower and clean myself after the gym, even if I wait when I get back, like say I try to eat before I shower after the gym, I can start to feel my skin itching And I can start to feel certain areas where I know I'm going to need to apply lotion because that is the way my skin is. So it's not going to work for all people. It has to be. This is, again, something we need to stop. Look, I'm all for like biohacking yourself. And what I mean by that is like, go take those tests where it shows you like what you can eat, when you can eat, how your body metabolizes. But that's individualized. We need to stop biohacking for a general everyone. Oh, this is what everyone needs to do. And the question I wanted to ask you is, isn't there a difference between what these people are saying and what Adam Carolla is saying? This seems more extreme than what Adam Carolla says.
I think this is extreme, but I think Adam Carolla would do this. So he's, you know, he's also gone full, not paleo, but low carb, no sugar, no grain. Dr. Drew went even further than him, by the way. Dr. Drew went on a 9-month meat-only diet, which is interesting.
I mean, I have to say that I've pretty much done that. I'm pretty much on that train. I mean, I have a weakness with sugar because, as my manager at work pointed out, that's your one vice. You don't drink, you don't smoke, you don't even do caffeine. So no wonder you have trouble not having sugar. It's your one vice. So I have trouble with that. But I have gone for a long period of time with only eating meat. And the truth is, I can feel my energy level get lower when I don't eat meat. I'll literally be like, I need protein. And people will be like, you're crazy. You don't need that much protein. And then I eat protein and I feel good again. And it's the best I felt in my life physically when I eat protein that much and I know I need it and then I eat more.
Yeah. So I think this is something Carolla would get behind. I think it's difficult, but the point I think they're making, Justin, not to crap on your point, is that, yeah, you might have body odor initially from this, but if you kept not showering or if you kept just washing off just with water, eventually the thesis is it would get better because the body odor comes from the unbalanced pH on your skin or whatever the hell the chemistry is that I don't understand. So that's sort of the thesis of this. Any thoughts on that?
So I'm supposed to believe that my greasy Italian hair would no longer be greasy if I didn't wash it for a few months? That's what I'm supposed to believe? Because if I don't wash my hair for a couple days, it feels gross.
So, confession time here. So I do shower. I shower every day. I have to. Otherwise, I feel horrible, actually. But I don't use any body wash, and I haven't for years. I don't use any soap, and I haven't for years. And I only shampoo once or twice a week. And the thing initially, Justin, is when I first started doing that, yeah, my hair was horrifying for like 2 weeks. But eventually, it got a lot better. And actually, now I think my hair, even though it's falling out at a rate I would prefer it not, is healthier than it's been in a very long time because I don't use as much soap on it. As for skin or whatever, like my skin is fine. I don't have any issues with breakouts or anything like that. So I get this. I still feel like rinsing off every day is important. I don't know. If I got up in the morning and I didn't shower, I don't know what I would do with my life because it wakes me up. It's fantastic. I'll turn on the cold water for a second.
Well, and that's the question I want to ask you, Daniel, is there's a cognate question that needs to be asked here that's not asked as the premise of this article. If what they're saying is true, and even if it isn't true, let's just put aside that for a second. Why did it become to this point that we have this culture where we shower every day and there's this industry with all this soap and everything? Now, I think the suppressed premise to answer why would one of them is, oh, well, it's all just a scam to get your money. It's just a scam to convince you need it when you don't. I think that's part of where these people are coming from. But is there a legitimate reason for this? And perhaps maybe it's just gone too far?
Yeah, I think with affluence, you get a lot of this in any realm. You know, we certainly do it in food, where it used to be that fast food was a treat that you would have once in a while, or that a sugar was a treat you would have once in a while. And then as affluence comes about, we have more and more disposable income, and then we want those treats more and more often because we can afford it. And so the market responds, because that's what the market does. It looks at what consumers want, and it gives them more of that thing and figures out ways to sell them more of that thing. So I don't think it's nefarious, and I don't think it's a scam. But at the same time, I do think that the market could adjust back, or the market could adjust to people not wanting more fast food. Or one of the more interesting ones in the food-related realm is that sugary drinks are declining for like the first time in 50 years or whatever, as people are seeking out more carbonated water or unflavored, unsugared drinks that are quote unquote more natural or more healthy. So I
and
think
again,
this is something
I'm on
that like
train
that
too. If you don't drink soda for a while and then you go back and try to drink it, it's way too sweet.
Oh yeah, it's horrifying.
But
yeah.
Daniel, to continue with what you're saying, the point I want to make is the affluence point. There is a value to showering and staying clean. And the way you have to look at it is, I always like to go to pre-industrial societies and think about it. So think about like the wealthy living in castles versus the workers. The workers did not have the ability to clean themselves after working out in the field all day. So they would be dirty and they would be smelly and there would be higher rates of diseases. Yes. Whereas the wealthy have all of this affluence and they're able to keep clean. So what happened when the market came about is people wanted to be cleaner because that was a sign of affluence, but it also worked and that made society healthier. Now, maybe it went too far in one direction, but the point is, if we all stop showering and we all stop cleaning ourselves, you know what would happen? There would be more diseases and everything.
The non-shower pact. Yeah, I agree with you to a point. And the point where I don't know where I agree with you, or I just don't know enough about it, is I think where we are today is probably too far. Because what we're actually seeing is, this was a fascinating article I was reading the other day, is, for instance, like North America, America in particular, but a lot of some European countries as well, I shouldn't say just North America, have absurdly high rates of allergies compared to other countries. Like in America, it's something like 33% or 36% of children have a severe allergy, which is ludicrous compared to the rest of the world. And even when you control for things like race, so they studied Israeli children in America and Israeli children in Israel. In America, 30-ish percent have allergies. In Israel, 6%. So the hypothesis is that at least to some degree, we're not exposing our children to the things they need to be exposed to when they're young: foods, allergens, dirt.
Poverty,
pollen.
Isn't this the last story we just talked about? It's the same thing.
So, you know, I think there is to some degree we've gone too far in terms of the cleanliness and the, you know, the affluence has taken us in a direction that is unhealthy and we probably should adjust back some degree.
Well,
I don't know what that degree is. I don't know if it's not showering ever. That's
no, it's
probably
not.
Too far, but you know, we could probably dial it back a tiny bit.
I think it's looking at our products and what they're actually doing for us and if they're actually helping us or not. I think the answer is looking on an individual level what you actually need to achieve your values. I think that's the answer for everything. And then, you know, once you figure that out, other people figure it out and the market will adjust. Again, this goes to a previous, I think it was the wealth story, but a previous story you were talking about where there's this distrust in the market, the idea that the market's giving us bad things. But an example I want to use here when we're talking about this affluence thing going too far, something you see here in Southern California is, I believe it's Chinese culture, where being tan is actually a sign of poverty because you're working in the fields all day. So there are Chinese people out here who are always, no matter the temperature, dressed in a way to cover themselves up because they don't want to get any sun. So they want to keep like porcelain Irish skin. And I've said that before. I don't understand why like Chinese people don't love like Irish gingers with porcelain skin. I'm like, they should love them. But yeah, it becomes to a point of irrationality, Daniel, where they're wearing visors all the time. They're wearing masks on their face. And it's making it so they can't live just a normal life. They're literally encumbering themselves to try and meet this irrational standard.
Yeah, agreed. Focus on your values. Focus on what is helping you achieving your values and be reality-oriented as much as you can. It is a standing order that you must focus on reality, on reality's terms.
Exactly. And I think that's a great way to end the news this week. And as you've heard, William is off right now because he is at a conference and also starting his he's launching his Jersey Mike's franchise. So if you're out in Long Beach, California, check out that. He actually gave the address in the Discord channel. And also Daniel has to go fix his pool, right, Daniel?
Yeah, we're having a little birthday party slash get together for Isaac and friends today. So my pool filter is dead and or dying and I need to go make sure the pool is clean for all of our guests. So I'm going to go do that. Hey, if you haven't had a chance to join our Midside Football, Fantasy Football League yet, the instructions are in the Discord channel. If you don't have access to Discord, you can tweet at Daniel T. Richards or email me or get a hold of me somehow or Justin and we'll get you in there.
And I actually just joined. Did you see that? I came out of retirement to join the Midside Fantasy Football League.
Fantastic.
Did you see my team name? Well, I think Daniel disappeared. I can't hear him. Daniel? All right, well, that's a great way to lose Daniel. And
I stopped hearing you for a lot of that last bit, so.
Oh, you didn't hear me?
It just sounded like,
I said, did you see what my team name is?
Oh, no, I did not see what your team name is. You can edit this out. I did not see what your team name is.
So that's a great thing. Everybody go join the league and find out what my team name is.
Ah, tease.
Tease. All right. I'm going to talk about some insane stuff that's happened in the entertainment industry this week. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML and No One Else. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. As you always hear me mention on this show, and as you heard me mention a few minutes ago that William informed us of his plans via Discord, you can join the Discord server and help participate in this show. You can send some trailers. I know Midsiders Megan and Midsider Frank, Midsider Megan and Midsider Frank, not plural as in Megan has multiple personalities. I know they enjoy sending in trailers, and I often use them because, you know what, they pick good trailers, and it lets me know what you guys want to hear. You talk about, hear us talk about. For this week, again, as I said in the transition, it's just going to be me. Daniel's out taking care of his pool. William is off with hackers or something. I don't know the exacts of it. But for the review, what I'm going to talk about is a movie I saw the night before recording this episode, Hobbs and Shaw. Hobbs and Shaw is the 9th Fast and the Furious movie. Now, it's not exactly a Fast and Furious movie because it's Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. It's starring The Rock as Hobbs and Jason Statham as Shaw. And in it, they're forced to work together to fight Idris Elba and save Jason Statham's character sister, Shaw's sister, who has injected herself with a virus that will melt everyone from the inside. The movie itself, there's not much to say about it. It's sort of like if you said McDonald's release their best burger ever. This is my favorite Fast and the Furious movie out of the entire franchise. I think it's probably because of The Rock. I think The Rock made the franchise better. If you listen to the previous episode where I talked about the whole franchise, The Rock was a turning point. I think this is another turning point. The writer, Chris Morgan, has written most of the franchise, and now he's spun off into this spinoff franchise. I think they're trying to create another team, which I'll get to in a second. But this is really carried by The Rock and Jason Statham, as you would expect, but The Rock in particular, especially because the entire third act takes place on the Isle of Samoa. Roman Reigns, another Samoan professional wrestler, is also in the movie. He plays one of sort of the backup, I don't want to say henchmen because they're the good guys, the backup muscle for The Rock. The good thing about this movie is it's pretty benevolent. You know, there's an evil corporation trying to improve humanity, sort of in the same way as Blue Sun in the Firefly universe, although we only see it as the the excuse, I don't remember the terminology, but the hybrid government between the Chinese and the English government in Serenity, it was eventually supposed to be Blue Sun. So this is sort of the idea as well, except it's a tech company. It's a tech company saying we're going to upgrade humanity because humanity in itself is weak. And in the end, there's a line where The Rock is like, you believe in technology and we believe in humanity and we have heart. You know, I'm not going to squabble about the association of heart with humanity. That's a very sloppy metaphor for free will, essentially. So I'm not going to get into that, especially you're going to start squabbling about philosophy in a Fast and Furious movie. But, you know, it has corny lines, it has cliche lines, it has a lot of cliche things, but it does it in a way that you can tell everyone's having fun and they're trying to make it look as good as possible. I mean, there were even sequences where they use Zack Snyder slow-mo. I wouldn't say it was a reference to him, but they're definitely influenced by him. And, you know, I'm not one of those crazy people out there who's like, Endgame is just Batman versus Superman redone in the Marvel Universe. No, I don't think that's true at all. I don't think they were trying to mimic or crib Zack Snyder for Endgame, but I do think there were some influence of Zack Snyder on here, especially in the final fight where they use the slow-mo to great effect. So you can definitely see Zack Snyder's impact on the genre here. But the thing that really stands out to me about this is some unadvertised and un-quote-unquote credited. How is it uncredited if you know they're, I don't know. They don't list their names in the credits. I don't know what that does contractually, but there were a couple actors who were uncredited, and it was a very enjoyable experience, a very enjoyable surprise. And I think they're building them in to have a future team movie with The Rock and Jason Statham. So there's going to be the main series team with Michelle Rodriguez and Vin Diesel, and then there's going to be the side series team with The Rock and Jason Statham. And I'm going to spoil it, so if you don't care, I'm sure you're just going to keep listening. But the first is Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds is sort of The Rock's handler in the CIA, even though The Rock's not in the handler, Hobbs's handler. And the cool thing about it is, and this is always something I wondered about because they named him Hobbs, Ryan Reynolds' character's name is Locke, and they have this sort of contentious relationship, Locke and Hobbs. I thought that was really cool. And there were some really funny bits there. I mean, it's essentially Ryan Reynolds playing like a PG-13 version, much less vulgar version of Deadpool. Exactly what you would think if you took Deadpool, took away his superpowers, and put him in the Fast and Furious universe. That was sort of the character Ryan Reynolds was playing. And then also, very appropriate for a Rock movie, Kevin Hart turns up at one point, and he's very funny, and you have that patter between The Rock and Kevin Hart. So, look, I would call this pulp romanticism. I might argue it's the height of pulp romanticism. You're not getting a great movie, but you know what? You're going to have a fun time at the movies, and if you enjoy our future president, you should see it. But if you're looking for high art, you definitely should not see this movie. You're just going to get upset about the cliché-ness, the corniness, and you're just not going to enjoy it. A couple other stories that broke this week in the entertainment movie realm that I want to talk about. The first is Universal pulled the movie The Hunt. This was a Blumhouse, I don't know how to say it. You know, the ones who released all of M. Night's recent movies. They did Happy Death Day, they did Get Out and Us. You know, they're sort of filling the void that Lionsgate left after Lionsgate moved on from low budget horror with the Saw franchise. After they made all their money at the Saw franchise, they started making other types of movies. Now Blumhouse is filling that void. And part of that was going to be The Hunt. The Hunt, the trailer I thought was excellently done. So it was done like an actual hunting trailer, like come to this lodge, come to this hunting reserve, come to this wildlife reserve, and you can hunt. And then it reveals at the end of the trailer that the game is actually human beings. So it's humans hunting other humans. Now, ESPN, initially, they were the first to pull this trailer. They wouldn't advertise it on ESPN anymore. I guess they thought there were problems with it seeming real and it being on their network. Although I think that's punishing the company, punishing the trailer for having effective marketing. Oh, your marketing is too good, so we're going to pull you from this network. And then, of course, after the recent incidences in Dayton and El Paso, they pulled the trail. They pulled the movie completely. Blumhouse pulled the movie. Universal, I think Universal is the distributor. Blumhouse is the production company. They pulled the movie completely. So they're saying, we're not going to show this anymore because it's offensive. And of course, now there are all sorts of squabbles going online about what the political nature of this film actually was, because the people being hunted are deplorables. They're called deplorables. And they're supposedly, one of them is the protagonist of the film. Now, of course, people on the left are saying that this proves that this was a right-wing movie, and that's why it was righteous to pull this movie, because you don't want a movie that upholds the right-wing point of view, that the left is all out to kill everyone on the right and they're against all of them. But I caution people before they start embracing this point of view, because the writer of this film is Damon Lindelof. This is Damon Lindelof, the same one who pushed forward Jack over... Hold on a second. Hey, stop it on the chair, Kat. Cats are just acting up today on the podcast. So, this is the same Damon Lindelof who pushed Jack over Sawyer on Lost. You know, Jack, the pussy beta left coast leftist, over Sawyer, the, you know, alpha Kentucky right-wing person. I don't know how right-wing he was. He was... I would say, actually, Sawyer was more libertarian if you see him, especially reading The Fountainhead. But that's the point, is this is who Lindelof took the side of. I mean, he took the side of the Yankees over the Red Sox. That's just a personal thing. But now we look at the new Watchmen adaptation, and we see him taking the worst parts of... Oh, wait, going back to Lost. He also made Hurley the ultimate savior in Lost. Hurley was the character. And what did he do? He cared about other people. All Hurley did was care about other people. Very second-handed. Very altruistic. So fast forward to the Watchmen adaptation. I haven't seen The Leftovers. Don't ask me to talk about The Leftovers. I won't talk about The Leftovers. I won't see it. I didn't see it because of what Lindelof did with Lost, and it had religious themes, and the religious themes brought into the sixth season of Lost. I have no interest in seeing The Leftovers. But that, you know, is part of the evidence, part of the argument. And then we have to look at the Watchmen adaptation. His new Watchmen adaptation. He takes all the worst interpretations of Rorschach and he bakes that into the show. The show is post the movie. It's not set in the same timeline, but post that storyline, post the storyline of the book. And in it, Rorschach has inspired an alt-right style cult. He shows them in a church. He shows them wanting to kill people and take America back. There's even an American flag in that scene. And they all use the Rorschach mask to remain anonymous. He also has it, so the cops have to wear masks to protect themselves from the Rorschach-type people. So Lindelof loves to do this thing, right? Because he's more of a traditional leftist than he is a modern leftist, right? He's not necessarily one of these leftists that's bought into the state. He might sort of still realize that irony. He's still more of a traditional leftist where it's like, yeah, fuck the man, where that was sort of the thing that libertarians in the left could agree on back in the day, which doesn't seem to exist anymore because the new generation of leftists don't seem to realize the irony of what they're doing, where they say fuck the man and then they, you know, want big government. So Lindelof is more of a traditional leftist. So what he loves to do is expose how both sides are insane and then pick something that's a left-wing point of view. So in the new Watchmen, I'm sure he's going to show the cops are insane and Rorschach's insane, and then we have to identify with the main characters and sort of be someone similar to Locke and Jack, or sorry, to Hurley and Jack. Yeah, I wish he would have had it identify with Locke. I mean, that's what I mean. Look at Lost. Locke. John Locke. He literally turned John Locke into Jeremy Bentham. And then after he was Jeremy Bentham, he turned him into the Man in Black, who was supposed to be the villain. And all the Man in Black did was give people choices. And what he did was supposedly he was giving them bad choices, you know, choices where they were going to get fucked over. So that shows you Lindelof's perspective. Anyway, I could rant about Lost all day. So I'm sure that'll be the same thing. And then if you look at this movie, right, everyone's so quick to say that, it's pro-right wing because it's, you know, the rich white elites, the rich left white elites hunting the deplorables. That may be true, but the whole premise of the movie is the girl, who's the main protagonist, I don't remember if she was even given a name in these synopses, she's trying to survive in order to get to the person in the center of it who puts on this reserve, who puts on this hunt, who was played by Hilary Swank. Now, if I'm a betting man, and I'm making predictions here, knowing Lindelof and knowing the way this style of writing works, I'd be willing to bet that, A, the girl either was mistakenly put there, or she's not supposed to be there, or, option three, well, there's a couple options. She's mistakenly put there. She's put there because somebody wanted to get rid of her because she was a problem. Or she did something that's not really that bad of a thing, but people see it as that. I'm thinking, if you remember Predators, the Robert Rodriguez version of the Predator movie, where they played with that, with the twist with Topher Grace's character at the end. I'm thinking something similar like that, except she's more good than she is bad. And I think you would find that early out in the movie, which would make you identify with her, even though she's among the deplorable. She's not really a deplorable. Then I think what would happen is you would get to the end, and you would find out that Hilary Swank is putting all of this on as a distraction for what she's really trying to do, which is really trying to control things from the from no one else noticing her. Sort of like what people are saying about the Jeffrey Epstein thing, right? Right. They're saying that, you know, there's a secret group controlling everything that are super rich, that are beyond the control of us. Right. I think that's the sort of perspective Lindelof would have taken. But of course, he would have taken it that they're evil and the only way to fix that is to care about other people or something. So ultimately, the only good guy in the entire movie would have been that one protagonist. Everybody else would have been evil, including the deplorables. So it would have been quote unquote complex, which is the value of a Lost. And it is Lindelof's ability. But the problem is Lindelof's ability, he only uses to serve a terrible philosophy that leads into his negative worldview. So if you want to know why Jack hates everyone and has such a problem with the world and is such a terrible leader, it's because ultimately Jack hates himself. And that's the problem with Lindelof as well. I mean, he even said that there was much about Jack that he identified with. There was a lot of him in that character. And then if you ever want to see what's really dangerous about Lindelof, look at what he said about the end of Breaking Bad and essentially identifying with Walter White. And anyone who identifies with Walter White, especially at the end of Breaking Bad, that's a major red flag. So I think it's a little more complex than people are trying to make this out to be, right and left. But I don't think this would have been any sort of right-wing movie by any stretch of the imagination. And it may not have been a modern left-wing movie, but it definitely would have been left-wing in the second-handed altruistic sense. The other thing I wanted to mention very briefly, just to sort of talk about its stupidity as far as like quotas go, because we've always talked about this on the show, you know, that eventually you're going to need a trans, black, disabled midget in all movies and make sure they get their screen time, is the idea that somebody went through and counted all of the lines for the women in Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, I haven't seen this movie. I have a morbid curiosity to see it because I know a lot of people are seeing it's tremendous, but I've had midsiders tell me, specifically midsider Justin Chang on Twitter told me that it's naturalistic. That was my sense from the trailer. And that's Tarantino's worst side is I find his movies to be very uneven because he has some brilliantly romantic scenes. I think about the speech Bill gives to the bride in Kill Bill Volume 2. Like, that's a tremendous scene. And if you look at Kill Bill Volume 2 as a whole, like, there's a tremendous thematic bent to that movie, and the choice of the bride matters. But then like, a movie like, I know this is heresy, like Pulp Fiction very much bored me because I didn't think there was anything really choice driven in that movie. It wasn't very interesting. And I find his movies very uneven that way, where he'll have some tremendous scenes and some terrible scenes. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood looked like Tarantino at his worst. So I didn't intend to see it. I don't intend to see it. But in his defense, counting lines in a movie is so surface level and it's so concrete bound that it's missing the point of art. And I dare say it's missing the point of life. The greater thing is, what is a character's thematic importance to a story? That could be a character who's in the story for 5 seconds, or characters in the story for 5 minutes or 5 hours. All of that is dependent on the content in the character's story when the character is on screen, not the number of lines he or she says. And a good example was Midsider Michael in the Discord channel was talking about all the strong female characters who don't say a lot. And, you know, I automatically thought of Mila Jovovich, because Mila Jovovich in The Sixth Sense, right? She's not in the movie for a long time. You know, The Fifth Element. I got my Bruce Willis number movies wrong. Sorry. The Fifth Element. In The Fifth Element, she's not in it a lot. But she is what Bruce Willis is striving for the entire movie. And then when she comes out, she doesn't say a lot. But she's very strong and very powerful. She is what the movie is built around. So would it be fair to count her lines versus Bruce Willis's lines versus all the male lines in that movie? No, it wouldn't. You'd be completely missing the point. Likewise, think of Mila Jovovich in all the Resident Evil movies. Her character is not a very verbose character. She shouldn't be. Not for the type of movie it is, and especially the type of character she is, especially what she's been through. So it's completely missing the point. Now, if there was some sort of argument about the theme of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, then I'd be okay with that. I'd take it more seriously. But simply counting the lines, it's shallow, it's concrete bound, it shows a complete lack of understanding for art, and I dare say that it's just pandering. It is pandering. All right, not much else to say this week. I appreciate you stopping by, taking a listen to this section with just me in it. Thanks, Daniel, for doing the episode, even though you've got some pool troubles. William will be back next week. Looking forward to that. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce. Just pay it's over back. Find the man who's most